You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Our very first story is a very exciting kind of news for renewable energy. So now there are thermal batteries that could efficiently store wind and solar power. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so solar power, wind power, they're all great, but if the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing, then we've got a problem because we obviously can't generate any power when there's no sun or no wind. So that's one of the big questions that's sort of standing in the way of a greener electrical grid. One of the answers are massive banks of batteries, but they're really expensive, and they can store energy, but they're really best about storing energy for a few hours and not for days or long stretches of cloudy weather or calm weather. Another strategy is to use surplus heat or surplus energy to heat a large mass of material to really high temperatures, and then tap the energy from that heated mass of material as needed. And this technology is called thermophotovoltaic technology. Yes, TPV, thermophotovoltaic. So we get the thermo for the heat and the photovoltaic for the sort of the solar cell part. What's been in the news is a nearly 30% jump in efficiency of these sort of devices. The idea is to feed surplus wind or solar electricity to a heating element, which boosts the temperature of a big liquid metal bath or maybe a big graphite block to several thousand degrees Celsius. And that heat can then be turned back into electricity by making steam that drives a turbine. But there are trade-offs, and high temperatures raise the conversion efficiency, in other words, the efficiency that the heat can be converted back into electricity. But turbine materials begin to break down at about 1500 degrees C. So this advance in thermophotovoltaics, I'll get it right, offers a better alternative than just generating steam to drive a turbine. And instead, they funnel their stored heat into a metal film or a filament, and it makes it glow like the tungsten wire in an old incandescent light bulb. And then these photovoltaics absorb that emitted light and turn it into electricity.
It's exciting stuff, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And so these things have been around since the 60s, the 1960s, and initially they only converted a few percent of the heat energy back into electricity. And in about 1980, that jumped to about 30%, which is okay. But in these new devices, these MIT professors MIT researchers have increased the temperature that this material is heated to by about 1,000 degrees, because that means that they emit when they're really, really hot. You know, things glow red or yellow or white when they get very hot. The hotter the temperature, the more white or blue they look. And so heating up to higher temperatures means they emit light at an energy that's better suited to these thermophotovoltaic materials. They're heating a tungsten filament up to about 2,400 degrees C, and they found that they can convert about 41% of the heat energy back into electricity. That doesn't sound great, but studies show that even at about a 35% heat to electricity conversion would make this technology sort of economically viable. And so if you can manage 40%, then it's sort of worth investing in this technology, and we may see it being brought to scale. And so this is ongoing work, and these sort of thermal storage systems are very modular. So unlike fossil fuel plants, which are most efficient at massive sort of gigawatt scales, These are much smaller. They can be added into, you know, into solar farms or wind farms of any size, and potentially help spread renewable energy.
Exciting stuff in the world of renewable energy, but I guess this kind of brings us to our next topic, I guess, in the sense that in case things don't work, there is a possibility of finding Earth 2.0, which is quite interesting. So tell us about that.
Yeah, maybe finding it, maybe not going there yet. Well, not for a while anyway. The Chinese are making plans to launch a satellite to look for extrasolar planets. That's planets that are outside our solar system, orbiting other stars. And in particular, they're trying to target Earth-like planets that are within the sort of habitable zone. So this is a distance away from their sun where they think life could exist. So it's not too hot, not too, so it's the Goldilocks sort of region. And so this mission will aim to survey planets outside the solar system in other parts of the Milky Way with the goal of finding these sort of Earth-like planets orbiting a star sort of similar to the sun. And more than 5,000 exoplanets have already been discovered in the Milky Way. And these have mostly been done using NASA's Kepler telescope, which was in use for about 9 years before it basically ran out of fuel in 2018. Some of those planets were rocky and Earth-like, and they tended to orbit smaller red dwarf stars, but none of them actually fit the definition of, let's say, an Earth 2.0. So it's an Earth-like planet in orbiting a star similar to the sun at the right distance. Mm. And now with current technologies and telescopes, it's really, really hard to find the signal of a small Earth-like planet. So when their host stars are a million times heavier and a billion times brighter than the planet, it's really, really difficult to see the faint planet next to them. And so this Chinese mission called Earth 2.0 hopes to change that. It will be funded by the Chinese Academy of Sciences and is wrapping up its early design phase right now. And if that all works out, then the mission team will receive funding to start building the satellite and hopefully aiming for a launch before the end of 2026. It's designed to carry seven telescopes that will observe the sky for 4 years. Six of the telescopes will work together to survey a particular area of space of the sky. And it just happens to be the same patch of sky that the Kepler telescope searched in. And the telescopes will look for exoplanets by detecting small changes in the star's brightness. And we're looking for changes in the star's brightness because sometimes these little planets pass in front of the star. And as they pass in front of the star, they block a little bit of the light from that star. And so you see a very, very slight dip in the brightness of the light from the star. And so these are very, very tuned to seeing very small changes in stars in the star's brightness. And this Earth 2.0 satellite will be able to observe dimmer and more distant stars than what the NASA satellites could do. And so they're about 10 to 15 times more powerful than the Kepler telescope. The seventh instrument will be what's called the gravitational microlensing telescope. And that's designed to look for rogue planets. These are free roaming planets that don't really orbit a star, and exoplanets that are really far from the star, like Neptune or Pluto is. And that'll detect changes in starlight when the gravity of a planet or star warps the light of the background star. So light tends to bend around massive objects. And so you can observe that by looking at these by looking through these type of telescopes. NASA launched Kepler in 2009, and they it was working great. But 4 years into the mission, part of the instrument failed, and that stopped the telescope being able to stare at one patch of sky for an extended period of time. And with this Earth 2.0 satellite, astronomers could have another 4 years of data that, when you combine with the Kepler observations, could help confirm which exoplanets are truly Earth-like. So the Chinese satellite isn't really a competition. It's building on what was done by NASA already. And hopefully, you know, within a few years, we might get an idea of, you know, how many Earth-like planets are up there.
It's kind of nice to not have competition for once. It's not a race to find something. It's actually collaborative work, which is always refreshing.
That's right. Absolutely right, yes. And now that's not to say whether the planet actually does have life on it, but they would obviously be strong candidates for that.
On to our final topic for today, monkeys. So monkeys can sense their own heartbeat, and you'd think that that's quite an easy thing to do, given that we can do it very easily. But obviously animals are a completely different realm. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I thought this was quite interesting. So, you know, when your heart races, because you've been running or you're frightened in some way, you can sense it, you can feel it. And according to this study, so can monkeys. And this is for the first time scientists have found evidence that a non-human sensing its own heartbeat. And this seems like it should be a no-brainer, but maybe it's a result that could help scientists study human emotions on a cellular level.
So how would they even be able to tell? Because you can't exactly have monkeys speaking to you and reporting back and being like, hey, you know yes. what? I can feel my heart pounding.
That's a good question. So this ability, the ability to sense our inner world, our insides, from everything from a pounding heart to a full bladder, it's known as interoception. So just as we use touch, taste, and smell to sense the outside world, interoceptive senses allow us to figure out what's going on inside our bodies. And they sort of ground everything in our human experience, from cognition to consciousness and things like that, and allows us to navigate the world effectively. Now, in recent decades, scientists have linked this interoceptive sensitivity to emotional awareness and a variety of mental health conditions. So people who are no good at heart rate detection, for example, are more likely than their peers to experience major depressive disorder. And by studying the physiology of interoception, so scientists hope to eventually learn more about how different psychiatric disorders emerge and develop.
Wow.
But as you say, it's a difficult thing to study, primarily because the relevant brain structures, such as the insular cortex, are situated in sort of no-go areas that are really inaccessible without really invasive surgery. So in an effort to find a sort of an analogous system, this group of scientists turned to monkeys because previous studies hinted that they may also be able to listen to their own bodies. So to find this out, the team replicated the design of a previous study on human infants. In that experiment, the scientists hooked up 41 babies to electrocardiogram, which monitored their heart rates, and an infrared eye tracker, which traced the directions of their gaze. So on a screen in front of the babies, the infants watched videos of bouncing shapes. These were just yellow clouds or pink polygons or blue circles or whatever. Some shapes bounced or bumped between the top and the bottom of the screen in sync with the baby's heartbeat, but others bounced asynchronously. In other words, they were a little bit faster or a little bit slower than the heartbeat of these babies. Now, because babies tend to pay more attention to stimuli they find surprising or out of place, these babies spent more time looking at the shapes bouncing out of sync with their beating hearts, indicating that they are attuned to their own heart rates, that sort of metronome that goes on inside them, and they're more interested in things that are not that heart rate, not beating with the same frequency.
Oh.
So this group of researchers repeated the study in four rhesus monkeys, rhesus macaques, I should say. All the monkeys distinguished between the synchronous and asynchronous stimuli, and the animals spent an average of about 1 second looking at the shapes bouncing at the same pace as the pulse, as their heart rate, but they took an extra 0.8 and 0.7 seconds respectively when the shapes move 10% faster or slower. They repeated this many, many, many times. The results held for 100 trials per monkey, and they closely matched the rates for the human babies. And so this is the first sort of solid evidence for interoception in non-human primates. And it's starting to open the door to some new methods that may help us understand its biological basis. And this finding could also help bridge gaps between physiology and behavioral psychology. Now we know that monkeys use the same interoceptive cues as humans do. Researchers can investigate connections between the heart and insula, for example, in creatures that are closer to humans, both behaviorally and physically. So most studies on complex psychological functions are now done with mice and rats. And they are wired differently. They have different neural hardware. They process senses differently from humans. And although there are ethical concerns working with non-human primates, they think the scientists will learn far more from the monkeys than they ever could from rats and mice.
I think, yeah, with monkeys being so similar, and you've seen a lot of behaviors that are quite fascinating and how they mirror human behavior, I think it's probably the closest you can get.
Yes, that's right. But the idea that monkeys, I mean, yeah, I guess it's, of course they would. Of course they would know their own heart rate, but actually showing that to be true and then learning a lot more about human psychology from the fact that this is true, from the fact that we can study monkeys in this way, is potentially really, really interesting.
Very exciting stuff in the world of science, and absolutely very worth it to get that on our show today. So thank you very much for joining us, Marcus.
You're very welcome. Have a good week.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.